to hear your views on these matters. And I know that I tend to lecture for a long time, so I will try to be short because, of course, my time is only half. And I'm so pleased to have Feng here, Feng, to help me with the other half. Thank you. I want to show you first just this map, which is, maybe we should turn off some of the lights. I don't need the lights, otherwise they can't see it too well. Yeah, this is a map of the Asian landed connections, the land territorial connections, known as the, thank you so much, known as the famous Silk Route. That you can see it is a very complex route. There are actually many, many different routes that link in different ways. And this is only part of the Silk Route, but you can see that it has, it existed, it began probably more than 2,000 years ago. So the land connections are very much there. It's these, right? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Go ahead. Just to talk a little bit about the history of Asia as a region. You're all familiar, of course, with the idea of the European Union as a region, and Europe as also a region. Of course, it's a continent, but now they're increasingly thinking of all the connections that make them into a region. And of course, you're familiar with ASEAN as a region, and I'll come back to that. Let us first remember that Asia is just a name given by the Greeks to the area just east of the Greece islands. In that sense, it's a cartographic, it's just a mapping name. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have empires that spread over the Asia, and most importantly, as I will talk about, networks that linked different parts of the region. And as I showed you, that was the landed route, which went all the way connecting different peoples here, all the way beyond what we now call the region. So I think of Asia as a region which has been made up of intersecting networks, right? And that's the idea I want to convey today, the idea of Asia as a network. And very soon we will come to this period from 1300 to 1850, where it is not so much the landed silk route, but the maritime networks that are important. And I just want to say also that these maritime networks depend very much on natural connections, in particular the monsoons. And we'll talk about Malacca as a center for monsoon connections. Thank you. Here is a depiction of, especially during the, or just before the Mongol Empire, which many of you know, begins around the 12th century, and really 13th, but some of it has already started there. And but it also, especially after the Mongol Empire, the landed route gets weakened, actually, because of divisions of the Mongol Empire. But the maritime routes take off, the sea routes. And you can see here, the blue connections are, of course, the sea routes that are connected the whole of maritime Asia. And let me see if I can show you where Malacca is. For those of you, this doesn't point. Okay, it's here. Oops. It's here. Is the arrow showing that? Yeah, it's here. And of course, what the British did was essentially move Malacca to Singapore. So Malacca was the place where, in fact, you had the monsoon trade winds, that was the point of exchange. When the winter monsoons brought ships from all the way from China to Malacca, and they waited for the monsoons to change directions, and then it would go back to the wind direction would change, and the ships could then travel back to South Asia and West Asia and beyond, so all of this region. Okay, thank you. What do I mean by networks? I'll just give some very brief descriptions and definitions. By networks, I still refer very much to social networks, networks of people. Though, of course, today when we think of networks, we think of it much more as mediated through technology, whether it's the new media, social media, or financial media, and so on. And all these are, of course, involved, but social networks, I think, are still very fundamental to thinking of Asia as a network. Social networks may be contrasted with social formations like a territorial nation, which has, you know, lots of institutions that protect it, and that has a certain conception of a type of space it is. For instance, you know, it is a space of the nation. People tend to get homogenized and follow similar cultures, and and there are institutions which are stable and rooted to those places. The authority of those institutions is contained within that space or that administrative entity. Of course, networks are things that are social flows that go beyond these kinds of administrative spaces. And of course, the two are interactive. Some people think that, you know, networks should be studied more than, and we cannot study one in isolation from the other, but nonetheless, they have different functions. And I think that let me try and say in advance one of the things I want to say, which is that the way in which the regions have been conceptualized in the world has been more like spaces, like territorial spaces. So, for instance, even Europe is becoming today like a territorial space, more like an enlarged nation in many ways. In many ways different too, but it's like that. This is not how I think Network Asia should function. It should still be more importantly connected to networks. So networks spread between spaces of flow and are organized around hubs and nodes, which are points of control or attraction. They're not typically defined by a contained or administered space. Networks are very important to expand. Sorry, is it too much?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Maybe if we could do maybe two, 3 points and then I'll do a translation.
Okay.
Yes, please, thank you.
Yeah, especially in these long ones.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. There are two more points I want to make about networks, simple points. One is that, simple but I think very important, networks, of course, are modes of expansion, right? They expand spaces of exchange and innovation, because when you exchange ideas and goods and so on, this other place can take off in some ways. And it's done through trade, through artifacts, through art objects, through ideas, innovations, beliefs, rituals. And so networks convey a lot. They're very dense. But the other thing, and that is very important for my argument, is that networks are also carriers of history. And here I want to make the point that we tend to think of history as happening within the nation, as if the nation existed from the earliest time and remains within the boundaries of the nation, that histories only affect that nation. But in fact, histories circulate. Something happens here, it affects something a long way off, even if it was thousands of years ago. And the main reason for that is that networks are carriers of these historical effects. And it's, let me give you a personal example. I am from...
First.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, this personal example I was going to give you, this is a part of India called Assam. And I am originally from Assam. It's the Brahmaputra Valley. And here, you can see. And I tell you, this is an area that you can see is contiguous with Southeast Asia. It's very close to Burma, very close to Thailand. And in fact, there is a community of Khmeres there from that came, I don't know when. What happened was that there was in South China, in Yunnan, during the Mongol period, just before the Mongol period, there was the Dai Lue Kingdom, which was an independent kingdom from China. It was a very important Buddhist center as well. And when the Mongols conquered Yunnan, they pushed out the Dai Lue, who then became very important part of the Dai or the Thai in Thailand. Meanwhile, that had an effect of pushing out a lot of people from this area who were here. And there's a group called the Ahoms, who are Thai-Burmese border people, who moved into the Brahmaputra Valley, into Assam. And the word Assam comes from Ahom. And of course, you know, I'm not Ahom. It's all mixed up now. There are groups of pure Ahoms. But the cultures are affected. So I want to show you how remote events affect things and displace people, continue cultures. And of course, that is, you know, you think of it as part of India, but it has as much connections with Southeast Asia. And so you can see these porous borders. And these just don't have to be just geographical. They're all kinds of borders. Okay. Now, I just want to mention, I'm going to start skipping some slides, but sure. There have been, since at least the 12th, 13th century, long trends of historical networks, both temporal and spatial networks, of Chinese, Indian, Jewish, Arab merchants, who had, in a very pre-modern time, they had these long, what is lengthy about them are their credit networks, the credit transfer mechanisms, which I'm sure Feng understands very well, and trading techniques that enabled wholesale trade across this entire Asian maritime region, and often the landed one as well. And in fact, so much so that when the Europeans came, they initially had to ride on their networks, especially to existing networks, but also to penetrate in further into markets. Right, so that was very important, and many of them survived, like the Chinese, the Jewish, and Indian merchant networks. They changed, but they survived European imperialism. And I'll just finish off here. I just want to say in the end that these networks were also carriers. While they were trade networks, they were also carriers of religion and ideas. So Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, and Islam in Southeast Asia came through trade networks. It was much more peaceful penetration than in many other parts of the world. Thank you. I'm going to skip a slide about, I've already made my main point about circulatory and national histories. It's that I don't want to exclude one from the other, but both have to be, there has to be balancing, rebalancing. But one of the things I try to show in my new book that I'm writing is that these circulatory histories are very interesting because they influence, as I've said, in culture and in all realms of culture, from belief, ideas, rituals, but also as represented in art. Here is an example. I'll just give you one or two examples. And the examples are from the spread of Buddhism into China, which probably begins around the second century. But really takes off in the 4th and 5th centuries of the Common Era. And one of the things that happens is that Taoism, which is a native Chinese religion, becomes very influenced. Of course, earlier also it both influenced and was influenced by other religions in the area. But it becomes very influenced by Buddhism. And for instance, the famous Buddha this god or bodhisattva who actually was a male in the Indian version, Avalokiteshvara, goes to China and becomes, remains a male for about five centuries, but then has a sex change in the 11th century, becomes Quan Yin, which is Kannon, which you must have in Vietnam too, Quan Yin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kannon, yeah? What is it?
Quan Yin.
Quan Yin, yeah. And so all this happens, but what is also very interesting is that Taoism felt, because Taoism didn't have a salvationist figure like Quan Yin, you know, somebody who saves souls, like Quan Yin, and so they too created a soul savior god-like figure. Of course, they denied it had anything to do with the Buddhist idea. And so this is the Taoist Quan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, whose name is Juku, succor your sorrow, your bitterness, right, to save you, heavenly god, was introduced because the novel savior figure had become too popular for the Taoists to ignore. So in competition.
Mm.
So, and you can see the aesthetic elements, how they combine so many Buddhist elements as well. Okay. You know, most of the time people talk about how it was a one-way thing, Buddhism influenced China and all these places. But in fact, there are several responses to this. It is very much circulatory. That is to say, it goes in, becomes something else, and goes out to other places, often comes back to a place like India to add something else. Not in the Buddhist case, but I will show how in other cases it does that. But also you notice that Buddhism also had to borrow from Taoism. So here is the reverse, the converse, where there is a god in the Chinese world, in the Sinic world, probably very important in Vietnam too. It's called Peiji, the Northern Dipper, the North Star, which was a Taoist god and very popular in Central Asia and China. And in order for the Buddhists to penetrate Central Asia, the Buddhist missionaries and so on, they created a bodhisattva out of the Big Dipper, out of the Peiji. And then this allowed for the penetration and facilitation. So this is how this kind of circulatory stuff works. And also in it spread. This is a picture from a Japanese Big Dipper Bodhisattva. So Japan and Korea also was very big.
The one in blue? The one in blue, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'm going to sort of truncate this section as well. During the period of Western imperialism in Asia, what was interesting, of course, is that these imperialist states tried to create a homogenized regions, homogenized colonies, right, that were dominated by what were nation states in Europe. They were empires, yeah, but there was France in Europe was a nation state, Britain was a nation state, and so on. And so it was a sort of a hybrid form, right? And but they utilize networks. They utilize the Asian networks, and they actually contributed to the spread of these networks because of the connections that the British Empire, in particular, had all the way from Aden in Saudi in the Arabian Peninsula to Shanghai and beyond across the maritime region. They also wanted to. When in the 20th century European imperialisms began to compete very much for each other, they tried to convert this whole empire and network into much more something like a colonial nation, right? And they created tariffs and barriers and this, that, and the other, and tried to create histories of that colonial region and so on. And this, I think, this kind of territorialization of networks and identities continues, of course, with the nationalist period. So I'll just leave it there. Okay, thank you. There was, however, a very interesting episode that represented a kind of anti-imperialist regionalization undertaken by networks again of Asian intellectuals and artists. I thought it would be particularly important to mention these philosophers and artists and cultural producers. Among these are, of course, Okakura Tenshin, the Japanese Pan-Asianist, Rabindranath Tagore, we will see their names more later, Chang Tai-yen, even Sun Yat-sen or Sun Jung-shan, and lots of Japanese and Asian Pan-Asianists. What their goal was to, theirs was a kind of anti-imperialism. They thought that Asia had historical traditions that were very powerful and important and very peace-loving. They were slightly essentializing about these qualities. And they felt that Asia should be able to make its mark in the world by providing an alternative to the warlike Europeans. And they created these networks, which, of course, they didn't have political power, so they mainly used artistic means and cultural means to forge linkages. One thing I want to say about them is that, or two things I want to say about them. One is that they were, they thought it was enough just to work among themselves as intellectuals. They didn't deal with the real interactions of all these laborers and migrants and merchants and other kinds of religious figures that were making the actual linkages in these regions during that time. They thought it was enough just to do the cultural stuff and that would, it would translate. Of course, you know, everybody has a role. The other thing was that they underestimated the power of nationalism and how, in fact, and that was, in fact, one of their stumbling blocks, because in the end, their regional project was hijacked by Japanese Pan-Asianism, which turned out to be, in the end, although it was not the case for many individual people, but in the end, it turned out to be a project of Japanese militarism. Okay, thank you. Yeah, this is, of course, these are some, Tagore was welcomed in, oh, sorry. Tagore was welcomed in East Asia, in Japan, but he was also criticized a great deal because he was, his not being radical and so on got him into trouble, that he, they claimed he was a cultural, civilizational essentialist and a reactionary. But there were many, including Kuo Moroe, one of the great Chinese Marxist philosophers. I mean, he was not fully Marxist, but he accepted Marxism, who was very close to Tagore, and of course, Shudramore was, the Poets' Society was, were very welcoming of him. But the relationship between these intellectuals, especially the Japanese ideas of Asia and so on, were in fact a very important influence in the artistic traditions of many places. There was a tremendous amount of cultural exchange and fusion that was going on. Here are some of the very famous artists of the Tagore school. And in fact, Tagore's own home was a very important place for these artists to meet. Nandlas Bose and Tagore's cousin, Abanindranath Tagore, who experimented with East Asian wash styles and ink styles and all kinds of things. And you saw also earlier Japanese artists trying to paint in India styles or whatever they wanted, thought of doing. One of the most important influences was actually Chinese and Japanese exchanges. Many Chinese artists discovered old classical Chinese art traditions in Japan. and brought them to and revived lots of traditions through this kind of reimportation, as it were, that was going on. I don't have time to talk about all of these, but and here you see Tagore was very much a missionary for this Asian unity, and here you see him in Baghdad, which is also, of course, where. Should I stop?
Yes, please. Stop.
Okay. I'm going to skip some more, especially my critiques of nationalism. But you can see here what I mean by, the homogeneous space. You see how these, in representations itself, you see this homogenization of space. Can you just say that? I just want to say that. Yeah, I wanted to put this eagle on this George Bush's head, but my technological skills were not up to it. Okay, let's come to the contemporary period. We don't have much time. But an interesting thing has happened with the globalization of the last 25 years is that actually regionalisms have appeared again. Right, there are movements of moving away from, precisely because I think that regionalism is both, it has good and bad factors, but one of the things that it does is that it enables people to address some of the issues that cannot be dealt with nationally anymore, because they are a product of globalization. So regional foci, and I think you can think of ASEAN as certainly one of it. One way to think of ASEAN is to make this region more competitive. The other way, and more productive way, I think, is to also see it as both enhancing economic possibilities, but also providing certain protection in the global, in the realm of the global, right? So that's all I'll say. Okay, I just want to show that how, in fact, economic integration within certainly a lot of maritime Asia has been taking place since the end of the Cold War, since the beginning of the globalization era, and I use as the basis of my study of this study by the ADB, Asian Development Bank, which talks about 16 Asian countries as having become much closer, much more closely integrated than they were, say, before 1990, and or actually before the Asian financial crisis in 1997. These are the 10 ASEAN countries: China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, of course, is part of the Chinese territory, and India. These countries had actually lost the kind of trade that they used to have among themselves during the period of the Cold War. And but then after the Asian financial crisis, we see that the total volume of trade between them went up from 33% to 58%. And by today, I'm sure it is close to 70%. So, and should I stop here? Go on.
That's fine if you go.
Okay. This is your area, so you can do that. The basis of integration is, of course, the vertical supply chain production networks. So for any Chinese product or Vietnamese product, you may have capital that may have come from Korea or Japan, technology from one of these places, maybe Taiwanese microchips and some Indian software or something, and these are all sort of integrated production chains. Financial integration is a little bit weaker, perhaps just as well given the history of the euro, but there is some movement in that direction, and there is of course much greater interaction in cultural flows, in tourism, in high-end popular arts, in Korean presence, Japanese presence, in many of the art forms, okay, or media forms, yeah. I want to emphasize once again that the necessity, the imperative for regional cooperation is growing, particularly because we are living now in what is called the Anthropocene. Is this a term familiar?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, good. Which, as a whole, which means that humans, for the first time in history, although some people claim that it started with agriculture, are determining the sustainability of Earth more than any other natural force. Whether it is terrorism, biological, chemical, economic epidemics, of course, we have global integration already taking place, but I think over and above all of that, what is very important are the environmental crises that we are generating and that need to be addressed through the networks, global networks and regional networks that we have. So whether through collective national arrangements or through transnational formations, the existing rules whereby nation states have sovereignty and can deny certain activities has to be breached to some extent by regional formations. And one of the most important things for this is water and what I call the regional commons, or what ADB calls the regional public goods, right? Water is a very important one, and the waters that of the 10 major Asian rivers that emanate from the Tibetan Plateau. Of course, you're all very familiar with the Mekong, but there's also, of course, the Salween or the New River in China, and the Brahmaputra, which also comes from Tibet and comes into Assam, which is Yalong Sangpo. Okay,
stop. I didn't know all the river names.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I'll just talk a little bit about the Mekong, which many of you I'm sure know about. The Mekong, which is called the Lansang in China, actually it has many different names in different parts of China and in, of course, in Tibet. But you have all these dams. There are 25 dams, many of which have been completed and some of which are. And unless proper studies of them have been conducted, it is now shown that this could affect very seriously the livelihood, just the Mekong itself, of 60 million people. And this could lead to a lot of displacement of course, the idea is behind it is hydropower. You want to be able to sell, create electricity, and modernize, and so on. But the kinds of disruptions that it may affect, and some of these effects are already being seen very much. For instance, this Manwan Dam in Yunnan, Manwan, here is already silting up much faster than they expected. And so what's very important here is that you have the Mekong River Commission and so on, that they need to be, nations have to be able to set aside their particular sovereign rights in order to be able to have transparency, to see what the effects are, to see what the effects will be, and accountability to do something about that. So I'll just leave it at that. And this is not just China I'm talking about, it's also the governments in these Southeast Asian countries. I've suddenly gotten to, there are also very important people-to-people links, of course, that have developed, and there are problems here as well. Basically, just to simplify the issue with people-to-people links is the nature of migration. You have now, of course, an expansion of migration from, as it were, developing Asia to developed Asia, right? And this is often labor migration, and it is something that nation states still control with a certain national interest. And so citizens from other countries are often affected poorly by this type of, the laboring poor. On the other hand, there has been, of course, a great expansion for the first time in history of Asian elite professional and capital migration, right? And they are, of course, beneficiaries. They are welcomed by all societies and given many, and so it is something that we have to keep in mind. I'll just say that it's a danger of regionalization that we have to keep in mind. Okay, this was more sort of high-tech interrelationship migration. These are Asians from all different professionals. I mean, they look very casual, like you and me, but that's them. And of course, this is the laboring migration that has to live in certain very tight quarters. But let me show you one other thing. Okay, I just want to show you this very interesting picture. I think there are many Vietnamese in Korea, and Korea has had a very interesting circulatory effect about migration, because about 10 years ago, Korean civil society groups apologized to the Vietnamese, as you know, for their role in the Vietnam War and so on. So that is a, but nonetheless, there are, if you look, but the point I wanted to make here is that this is a migrant protest in Korea. The interesting thing is that many of these slogans, this is a language I read, are in Bengali. They are Bangladeshi migrants who are writing this thing in Bengali. I'm not sure why, but that's their language, I guess. And all these different languages that's being represented here, just in the protests, I think is a very interesting development. Okay. Okay, finally, I want to say that I think ASEAN, although of course we know that it has many weaknesses, and the kind of unification wants to create in 2015 is not going to happen that fast. But what I want to say is simply that it, on the other hand, has been very successful in many ways. And one of the ways it has been successful is that it has really become the magnet for drawing other powers towards it, to cooperate with it, to enmesh them in their in what they call commercial diplomacy, to sign these FTAs, to sign the TAC, which is the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation. And all these powers, whether they be regional powers like China, which is considered number two among ASEAN leaders after the US, or Japan, or India, or these, and subsequently Russia has also gotten involved, and everybody's stumbling over to join this, to create agreements with ASEAN on its terms, on TAC, the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation. Okay, I want to make this last point. I think ASEAN has, not my very last point, but this point, created the basis of an open and inclusive regionalism, which creates commitments to regional prosperity and peace. But it is very different from the European Union model, right? Because it's a much looser architecture. States will remain states and so on. It resembles, to a limited extent, really the maritime Asian networks that I talked about, because, well, in many ways, because, you know, it doesn't involve creating one political, economic, cultural power, but allows them to coexist. Okay. Of course, the million-dollar question here is the role of China. With China, which cooperated, was one of the first powers to cooperate very closely with ASEAN, and still does, nonetheless has also created some tension, especially after dependence on its economy has grown, and this whole region has now become much more dependent on China's economy. So what kind of role will China play? I don't think we need to go further into this, but it is certainly an open question, and I think there are forces in China that can be persuaded to play a constructive role in what has been evolving as a peaceful regional network suggestion, right? So I think my conclusions have already been made, so I'll won't say any more and leave some time for questions and answers. Okay. Or questions and your suggestions.